Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Dan Friedel, John Russell, Mario Ritter, and Christopher Jones Cruz. Later, Anne Ball will have this week's Science in the News report. But first, here is Dan Friedel.
State fairs are one of the great U.S. summertime traditions. Just ask Don Griman. He has been going to the Iowa State Fair since just after he was born, 89 years ago. Griman said state fairs started in the mid-1800s because farmers wanted to have a gathering to show off their produce each year. For example, farmers that raised cows wanted to see how their cows compared to the cows of their neighbors. Over time, state fairs evolved into bigger events, much bigger events.
The women thought to say, you know, our husbands are proud of their livestock. We're sort of proud of our baking and cooking and garment making. So we ought to have a little fair, too. And that's how fairs started. And then somebody could maybe play a fiddle or have a little entertainment with it. And that's how it sort of evolved. And then they decided, well, hey, well, let's make this an annual event.
Today, some state fairs average over 100,000 visitors per day. The nation's most popular fairs, including the one in St. Paul, Minnesota, attract almost 2 million visitors each year. Most state fairs run for a little more than a week between August and October. They have craft exhibits, lots of live music, games, and rides like roller coasters and Ferris wheels. Some even have wine tastings, beer gardens, or competitions to see who can bake the tastiest cake or make the best sculpture out of butter. Above all, state fairs have a lot of interesting food. Consider a bucket of chocolate chip cookies at the state fair in Minnesota, fried butter at the Texas State Fair, or a pork chop on a stick at the fair in Iowa. We have 72 foods on a stick now. That seems to be the rage, said Griman of Iowa. Corn dogs, butter on a stick, Oreos on a stick.
You name it, we've just about got it on a stick.
Eating is one of the most popular activities at state fairs around the country. It is where some of the most interesting cooking techniques and food creations are found. Jim Hasbrook owns one of the popular food stands at the New York State Fair, which takes place from August 25th to September 5th this year. His stand is called Fried Specialties, but he may be better known as the Deep Fried Guy. That is because he will put just about anything in batter and fry it in oil. He sells fried peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, fried pickles, fried jelly beans, fried candy bars, and even fried lasagna. He has 35 items on the menu.
Everything's friable. everything. I've done everything up to whiskey and fruits. I've done everything. Everything's friable. It's all in the process, how you do it. If you want to take the time and come up with a process and you can and toy with it, you can make it happen.
This year, he has a special fried creation. It is called the Harvester. The sandwich includes mashed potatoes, stuffing, fried turkey, and other items that recall the U.S. holiday of Thanksgiving. Hasbrook loves frying food so much that he sold his construction business and devoted himself to making fried items. "This is what we do full-time now," he said. Hasbrook attends multiple fairs and festivals each year, but he is from New York and loves being at the New York State Fair.
My blood gets flowing. I feel like a kid again. It's just a great thing, and I don't think you can go wrong with going to a state fair.
If you want to visit the king of all fried items, it is a good idea to pack your bags for Texas. That is where you will find Abel Gonzalez. Some people call him Fried Jesus. The State Fair of Texas runs for almost a month, from September 30th to October 23rd. It is located in the city of Dallas. Gonzalez impressed food critics from all over when he came up with fried butter in 2009. His creation was so good that the newspaper in Dallas wrote that he should be named Texan of the Year. Fried butter is a sweet square of butter that is rolled in batter. It is then fried. The result is something like a bite-sized bread roll with the butter already melted inside. Gonzalez won the fair's food competition for his fried butter. He went on to be featured on television shows and in food magazines. State fairs can also be a good place for politicians to meet the people they represent. The New York Times has a story of the New York State Fair in 2000. In that year, Hillary Clinton was campaigning to become a senator. Clinton and her husband, then President Bill Clinton, stopped at a well-known food stand at the New York State Fair for a sausage sandwich. The first couple happily ate one sandwich each, according to the story. They posed for photos and joked with voters and reporters. But Clinton's top rival for the Senate position did not eat the sandwich when he was offered one. Clinton went on to win the election 2 months later. Musical performers attract a lot of people to state fairs. The fair hires popular singers or bands to perform and draw more people to the fairgrounds. Here are some of the well-known performers coming to state fairs in the coming months. If you want to see singer and dancer Jason Derulo, you can go to the Iowa State Fair on August 14th. And if you want- Dolly Parton will sing at the Ohio State Fair on August 2nd. Jolene, 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 I'm begging of you, please don't take my man. Bruce Hornsby will be at the New York State Fair on August 28th. That's just the way. And Nick Jonas and Demi Lovato are at the Minnesota State Fair on August 31st. Call it passive or aggressive. I turn the machine music up. state fairs have many modern parts these days. But at its core, Don Griman of Iowa says the event still aims to bring a variety of people together for a few days of fun. He says the state fair is a way for our city cousins to look at the animals because they don't have the opportunity to see them every day like we do, to try different food than usual. Not everybody has a corn dog or butter on a stick. And then, of course, the entertainment. There's something at the fair you can't see every day. I'm Dan Friedel.
Nabaz carefully poured red wine into a glass, then another glass. He set the bottle down and looked at the small group of people he had never met. Then he offered them his wine. This was the first time that Nabaz himself had offered his homemade alcohol to others. "I was a little anxious to see the reaction," he said later. "Obviously, this to me is a work of art, and all art depends on how people see it and evaluate it." For Nabaz, the small gathering has special meaning. The wine tasting event was, in some ways, a triumph. "I felt this was extending a hand of friendship, of offering something unique from Kurdistan, and offering something for the very first time by Iraqi Kurdistan to the outside world," he said. The Iran-Iraq War lasted from 1980 to 1988. During that period, some Kurdish militants in Iraq sided with Iran. Then Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein ordered his forces to take steps to punish the Kurds. In a 7-month offensive, between 50,000 to 100,000 Kurdish villagers died or disappeared. Nabaz had studied civil engineering while in school, yet he decided to leave engineering behind and fight against Saddam Hussein's forces. He joined the Kurdish fighters in the mountains for 8 years. "It was the most meaningful period of my life," he said. It was during the time in the mountains that Nabaz noticed Kurdistan's grape crops. Most of the grapes were used to make juice or raisins. Nabaz loved wine and decided to explore different ways to produce it. For the past 6 years, he has experimented with different grapes and different winemaking processes. Now he has his own wine, which he calls 21 Rays. The name comes from the rays of light on the Kurdish flag and the strong sunlight that shines on the area. Nabaz says wine lovers in London have praised his product, but in Kurdistan, 21 Rays remains a secret. Stores do not sell his wine. The grape growers do not know that Nabaz uses their fruit for wine. Only Nabaz's close family know about his winemaking. Wine is sold in Kurdistan, but usually only in Christian neighborhoods. Nabaz's family is Muslim. Observant Muslims do not make, sell, or drink wine. If members of Nabaz's extended family knew that he made wine, they would not approve. Respect for Islam keeps Nabaz from selling his wine, but fear also plays a role in his decision. Daesh is only a few tens of kilometers away, Nabaz said. One has to be discreet. Daesh is the local name for Islamic State fighters. Nabaz plans to produce a few hundred bottles of wine after the upcoming harvest. He does not use machines. Instead, his close family members take the grapes and crush them. For now, 21 Reis will remain a secret in Kurdistan, known only to a few. I'm John Russell.
Immigration and border security are two major issues in the United States presidential election campaign. The candidates of the two main parties have voiced different ideas about border security. The Republican Party's candidate, Donald Trump, has proposed to build a wall along the U.S. border with Mexico. Hillary Clinton, the Democratic Party's nominee, has taken aim at that proposal. On July 22nd, President Barack Obama hosted his Mexican counterpart, President Enrique Peña Nieto, at the White House. The idea was to publicize the good relations between the two countries. Americans living near the Mexican border have as many different views as those voiced at the recent U.S. political conventions. Some want to continue good relations with Mexico. They want to keep the boundary area secure. They also want to increase business with their neighbors on the other side of the border. For example, goods and people cross between Nogales, Mexico, and the U.S. city of Nogales, Arizona, at the new Mariposa Inland Port. Many Mexicans with visas pass through the crossing station to buy goods or work on the U.S. side. There is a long wait on both sides of the line, and a large barrier has been built along the border there. The Reverend Randy Mayer is a migrant rights activist. He says many Mexicans decide to stay in Mexico when they see the crossing.
What happens here along the border is that commerce and business is almost stopped, and what should be a multi-billion dollar industry is actually suffering.
Cross-border commerce continues to help Nogales and also the city of Tucson, Arizona, which is about 100 kilometers to the north. Mike Varney is president and chief executive officer of the Tucson Metro Chamber of Commerce. He supports a balance between border security and commerce.
We want to keep bad people and bad things out of our country, but at the same time, we don't want to put the brakes on cross-border trade.
Varney points out that Mexicans seem to add a lot to the local economy.
Mexican citizens come to the Tucson area and spend about $1 billion a year in our stores, in our hotels, buying all kinds of services and products here.
However, Varney says companies that do business across the border are even more important. These include companies that open headquarters or special offices in Tucson to direct cross-border manufacturing projects. Import-export businesses also are important to the area's economy. Varney is frustrated by the way the border issues are discussed in national news stories.
Economic expansion and job growth just doesn't have the sizzle that a drug bust does. But obviously we cherish the international trade that we enjoy here in Arizona, and we certainly want to do everything we can to expand that.
Many Arizonans blame illegal immigration for suppressing wages in the United States. And they say illegal immigrants increase education and health care costs and violent crime. Voters in Arizona have supported proposals to limit immigration. But Varney notes that business leaders have lobbied for less restrictive measures.
It's a mix of politics, it's a mix of trade and economy, it's a mix of international relations, so it's a complicated recipe, and we need to pay attention to all the ingredients that go into that recipe.
He says there are even more possibilities for bilateral trade and commerce once other border crossing stations are completed and fully operational. Mexico is America's third largest trade partner. The Office of the U.S. Trade Representative says trade between the two countries is valued at more than $580 billion. Mexico is currently the second largest export market for U.S. goods and services. I'm Mario Ritter.
Filmmaker John Rowe discovered a secret after many visits to the Omo River Valley in Ethiopia. People there thought some children were cursed. Villagers blamed the children for sickness, a lack of rainfall, and other problems. So they killed them. The Omo Valley is a place of beauty. It is home to villagers with customs that date back many generations. Rowe says the villagers believed that if a child's teeth first appear on the upper gum instead of the lower part of the mouth, the child is cursed and must be killed. He says children are also killed when they are born to a woman who is not married, or if they are disabled or are twins. Rowe heard about this belief from Lale Labuko, the man who helped him during his visits to the Omo Valley. Rowe made a documentary film about the practice. He called the film Omo Child. Labuko says that when he was 15 years old, he saw a 2-year-old child being drowned in a river. His mother told him that he had 2 sisters who were killed before he was born. In the film, Labuko says, "I want to stop these things." Labuko was the first member of his village to be educated. He asked Rowe to help him end the killings. First, he persuaded some young villagers, then families and leaders of the village. Rowe's son Tyler filmed the documentary over a 5-year period. He says some people admitted they had killed their children, but others said children were not killed. Tyler says some villagers told him, "It doesn't happen here." Labuko's work caused people to begin speaking out about the practice. His tribe agreed to ban the killings in 2012. A charity group created by Labuko and his wife has saved more than 40 children. They now live in a home in Jinka, Ethiopia. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Solar cells have been around since the 1950s.
But now there is a race to develop transparent solar cells that can cover windows of buildings and still capture the sun's light for electricity. There are three kinds of light that reach our planet from the sun. They are ultraviolet light, or UV, visible light, and infrared light. Together, they make up what is called the solar spectrum. Troy Townsend is a solar cell researcher at St. Mary's College of Maryland. He says working with the transparent solar technology for windows means you cut the efficiency in half. That is because you are letting visible light, light you can see, pass through the solar cells instead of capturing and using that light to make electricity. That leaves only light from the ultraviolet and infrared parts of the light spectrum to make electricity. He spoke to VOA via Skype.
One of the major challenges with transparent solar cells is developing a system that would allow you to absorb the maximum amount of UV and the maximum amount of infrared.
Because glass absorbs UV light, Townsend says the efficiency will drop even more if the solar cell is on the inside of the window. But if the cell is put on the outside of the window, it could capture the light before it goes through the glass. That would require the cell to be protected from the elements of heat, moisture, and cold. Townsend says the trick would be to find a clear material that would cover the cell and still let the light come through. Several colleges and private laboratories are working to develop photovoltaic compounds that could be applied to windows. They would be transparent, which means you can see through them. So they would be able to collect the sun's energy without blocking the view through the window. Solar Windows Technologies in Maryland says it has developed an efficient, transparent solar cell. John Conklin is head of the company.
We've actually taken a technology, organic photovoltaics, and innovated it into a transparent technology, apply it to window glass, and turn a passive window into an active electricity-generating window.
Conklin says a solar window can be totally transparent, or it could be tinted or colored, which makes it more efficient.
We can make the color darker or lighter, or blend the colors to go with a blue-green, a green-gray, a brown, depending on what the architect, the building owner, or the building developer is looking at.
Conklin says his company is working with the U.S. Department of Energy to test and develop the technology. And he plans to have a commercial-ready product by the end of 2017. If he is successful, Conklin says his electricity-making window could pay for itself in 1 year. According to a 2012 survey, there are 5.6 million commercial buildings in the U.S. They have more than 8 billion square meters of windows. Even if only a part of that glass could collect power from the sun, it could greatly lower the need for polluting fossil fuels. I'm Anne Ball.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.